From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I'm here with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, who is dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Hello, Dr. Denise, Queen's English teacher Pope.
Ooh, we're already getting into it.
Yeah, so were you like a grammarian when you taught? I taught English too.
I know. We both taught English. Yeah. Look, this is the thing. I taught English and I truly believed that you didn't have to study grammar in a boring way where you just wanted to die when you had to diagram sentences and all that stuff.
You mean like linguistics?
Okay. Well, what I would say.
Sorry, our guest today is a linguist, so I just had to get it started going.
The study of language is what linguistics actually is, okay. Right? Isn't it? So anyway, I have some pet peeves. ITS versus IT apostrophe S. I can't tell you how many times people get that wrong, and I have a little trick of how people can know it.
Tell me.
Okay. Can stand for it is, right? It is my birthday today. The apostrophe is like the little baby I. You just take the I out and the little dot on the I, that becomes the apostrophe. It is, two words. The apostrophe connects it is. It's like
that's awesome.
The dog wagged its tail. You don't have that little thing there.
That's awesome.
So do you know how many people get that wrong? You know how many? It kills me. I see it in print. I see it on billboards. I once went up. This is embarrassing. But I will admit it. I once went up to a children's creativity and learning center, and it was spelled children's, I'm not making this up, childrens apostrophe.
So I was right. You were the Queen's English teacher.
Okay, children's is already plural. You don't do S apostrophe. And I went up and I told them, I'm like, you're educators of children. I know this is really, I'm not trying to be rude or anything, but your sign is wrong. Yeah. And it's killing me.
Somebody got fired because of that.
I highly doubt. No, it's still there. I pass by it every day.
So when you would grade papers, you would go after apostrophes. That was like the number one thing you would look for in an essay.
No, I take my paper grading very seriously, and I grade according to a rubric that has very good, what is your claim, what's the evidence, all that stuff. But yes, there is a little part of my grading rubric on writing, because if I don't understand what you're saying, then no matter how great your ideas are, I'm not going to be able to understand it. And can I tell my story about a little issue that I had?
Please.
Okay, so I was grading, had nothing to do with sort of IT apostrophe S or anything like that, but I was grading a paper that a student wrote in a style that I was not used to, and that is not usually how papers get turned in. And I wrote back and said, this is really casual, like not even full sentences, and words that were very colloquial. And I just said, for a paper for a graduate student at Stanford University, I'm just giving you some feedback that this is too casual, that it needs to be a little bit more formal.
Crush beneath the wheel.
I was really nice about it. I said, you can redo it. I give you, a totally different new grade, et cetera. But she was really upset. I offended her.
Why?
Because that's the language that she uses, and I was disrespecting the language that she uses.
Do you buy it?
I don't know.
Or was it just
this is why I'm really glad we're doing this show today, okay. Because I have so many questions for our guest, because I don't know.
Okay, so I'm now about to put Jonathan Rosa on the hot seat. So Jonathan Rosa is a professor of education at Stanford. He's anthropological linguist. I want to get the grammar right.
What do I say?
You could call me a linguistic anthropologist.
There it is.
That's
there
better.
We go. Linguistic anthropologist. Thank you. He studies how language and race intersect, and he has a hot new book out called Looking Like a Language and Sounding Like a Race. Ooh. So thank you for joining us, Jonathan.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
What should Denise's response been? Should she respect the student's repertoire or crush the student under the queen's language?
Excuse me. It was not. I couldn't have been nicer. I thought it was sort of my duty to say this, but maybe not. Maybe I'm totally out of place.
No, it's like telling me I have to wear a tie.
Well, are there some times that your boss says that you have to wear a tie?
Yes.
Okay. Jonathan.
Okay, sorry. Back on track.
Well, first let me articulate the profound sense of kinship that I experience with Denise in relation to linguistic prescriptivism.
Okay.
So I am someone who, when I worked at a grocery store as a high schooler and while I was an undergraduate student, I would take the weekly ad that was circulated from the grocery store where I worked and take a red pen to it and bring it to the store manager. So things like children's. That was the sort of investment that I had in an idea about linguistic correctness. So that was really important to me.
You feel my pain.
Oh, and I think the feeling part is really important because on one level it's a linguistic phenomenon, but on another level it's sort of an affective question of taste and the sense that, you know, you can experience disgust in relation to these sorts of practices. And what's really difficult is figuring out where those experiences are coming from. And, you know, one of the funniest things that happens to you when you take your first introductory linguistic course in undergrad, and for many of us, we're taking this course precisely because we're obsessed with language and obsessed with correctness. And then the first thing they say is, there's no such thing as correct, and linguistics is a descriptive versus a prescriptive science, which means we study the way people use language. We don't tell people how to use language. Right. And I said, so what's the point?
Why am I here?
I'm here to perfect this practice that I've been honing for decades at this point.
Welcome to the ivory tower in academics.
I just felt like you all have totally just, you know.
It's all gray.
Totally
it's
removed gray. Any relevance to the field of study. So I think it is a difficult situation, though, where you have someone who's saying, look, I'm communicating to you or I'm completing this assignment using language practices that make sense to me. You're suggesting to me that they don't make sense to you or that they don't conform to a norm. And so should I conform to your norm? Who gets to stipulate all of that? And so immediately you're brought into these questions about power and institutional hierarchies and authority, this sort of thing. And that's why these language issues are so interesting to me.
So this is a little tangential, but why we do that in language? I don't hear that in math. Like, you know, sorry, this is my math, that's your math. Why? And it's another constructed symbol system. What makes language special in this space?
So I think that part of what's so exciting about language is the way that its study can work across what we understand to be the conventional sort of disciplinary boundaries, you know. So math is typically the STEM field or it fits into the natural sciences and you have your social sciences and humanities. And the study of language really crosses all of those fields. So whereas math, I think there's this sense that it's an objective standard that you're trying to which you're trying to adhere. With language, there's the sense that it's a cultural practice, a historical practice, an artistic, expressive practice. And the idea that one's artistic expression should conform to a norm precisely violates the point of artistic expression on some level, at least in some ways. But there's a complex sort of debate there, or tension there.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're speaking with Jonathan Rosa on language and race and people's impressions as people speak different ways and write different ways. It's tough.
So language is, rather than being a universal, it's somewhat culturally defined. And then I hear you speak a language and suddenly I assume you are of a type.
Sure. That's part of what's so interesting to me, these mundane, everyday sorts of interactions that take place in relation to language or through language that, in fact, mobilize all kinds of histories and all kinds of relationships and experiences that we don't necessarily pay attention to or we're not necessarily thinking about in the immediate moment of interaction, but that are definitely at play in shaping our impressions of who people are, of whether they're intelligent or unintelligent, whether they're professional or unprofessional, legitimate and illegitimate, this sort of thing. And so these really consequential sort of perceptions of people.
So the intelligent, unintelligent strikes me as really an important divider. So if I could do this with fashion, different cultures have different fashions, I probably don't respond and say, bell bottoms, oh, you must be inferior.
Well,
but language, I'm willing to do this. Well, I mean, not me personally, but one is willing to do this.
This is a joke that I heard. I don't know that there's truth in it, but someone said, if you speak with a British accent, a proper British accent, whatever that is, Queen's English British accent, it is as if your IQ has been raised by a certain amount of points. And you know what? You could see how that could be, right?
Do tell.
Yes, yeah, see? I'm telling you. There's just – so it's not even just race. It's region, right? There's different – you know, people from Philadelphia say – my dad's from Philly. He says words, you know, a soda, pop, bubbler, right? That you can pick this out. So it's not just race.
The vowels are fun in Philadelphia. So you get Wooderice is
yes.
a description. So I'll never forget my undergraduate RA in my freshman year. And Dean Schwartz and I both were our Swarthmore alums, or
yes.
Swarthmore.
Yes.
And my
Swarthmore. With an R.
But my RA was from down the street from the college, and his name was Brian. But when I first heard his family call him Brian, I just was like, where am I? What part of the world is this? But yeah, these regional sorts of variations, also race, class, gender, this sort of thing. But the arbitrariness, so when you suggest that, oh, if someone speaks with what is stereotypically perceived as a British accent, and this is, again, in the U.S. context, because, of course, in the British context and across the British Empire, there are lots of stereotypes about different kinds of Britishness.
Yes.
But in the U.S. context, the sort of, you know, crude iteration of this is, oh, they speak with a British accent. That's closer to the Queen's English, and so that must make them more intelligent. So it can be quite arbitrary, and that's part of what's so fascinating to me, that the very sorts of forms, linguistic practices that we position as signs of correctness, legitimacy, intelligence, I can find those practices across virtually every variety of language. It just so happens that it's forms that are stereotypically constructed in relation to particular populations that are elevated to the status of correct.
Right, but it's not exactly arbitrary. So like Levi Strauss, anthropologist, would talk about how villages, one after another, would sort of say, oh, they're skunk eaters, right? And they would basically identify them because they ate some food they didn't, and they would say that's pejorative. So which languages have ascendancy is probably not arbitrary. It's a power. It's power. Right?
Absolutely. And I point to people, examples of this all the time. So quintessential example, racialized example in the U.S. So you talked about the it's, which doesn't carry the distinction between ITS and IT apostrophe S, which doesn't carry as much of a racialized kind
right.
of distinction, but
right.
a classic racialized example would be something like axe versus ask. Axe is stereotypically constructed as a African-American language practice in the United States. But that kind of switching of sounds is linguistically, we call it metathesis. It happens with many practices. The month that we're in is February or February.
Are you
comfortable or comfortable? Is it different or different?
What's the word that you use? Metathesis?
Metathesis.
And what does that mean?
It just means a switching of sounds. So axe and ask, is this February or February?
Oh, interesting.
Is something different from something, or is it different from something? And so whereas February isn't racialized and different isn't racialized, axe is racialized, not because of linguistics. So as Dan was pointing out, it's not arbitrary. Linguistically, it's kind of arbitrary in the sense that those linguistic practices are the same. Different and axe are the same, but they're racially stereotyped in very distinctive ways, and that ends up becoming consequential so that it attunes our attention to particular practices and not other practices.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Jonathan Rosa about linguistics and how people talk and the connections to race and region and a whole bunch of things. And I have to say, so as a teacher, how do you handle this? So it's all good? It's all good? You say it your way, you say it your way, you write your way, you write your way. Like, what should I do as a teacher?
Go after the apostrophes.
Oh, well, I will definitely go after the apostrophe. But I mean on some of these other issues that are much more contentious.
Yeah, I mean, part of what's exciting to me about language is recognizing that there are patterns everywhere. And the question then for me becomes, what would it look like if in our classrooms we became curious about all of these patterns? And that involves paying attention to practices with which we might be familiar in a different way, where we might be paying attention or looking for different kinds of patterns in those practices with which we're very familiar. And conversely, thinking about practices with which we might not be as familiar and trying to look for patterns that we might not have noticed there before as well. And so in our classrooms, what I think it involves doing is broadening the set of questions that we're asking about language and trying to move away from some of the assumptions that we bring to language. So as an anthropologist, one of the things we always say is it's our job to take something normal and try to imagine a perspective from which it could be experienced as strange, and vice versa, taking something that seems strange and trying to understand a perspective from which it's normal.
So I think Denise is trying to be much more concrete. I have a kid who is not using the Queen's English. I don't want to violate their own language practices. So what do? I say, well, look, here are two different ways to say it, right? And I just want to draw this to your attention so that you'll be fluent in both, or like how do I broach this? I certainly want them to have a heads up that there are people who are going to respond negatively to this kind of language. You still can own it, but I mean, am I making stuff up? Is this a bad idea?
I think, I'm going to add one more layer to this. As an English teacher, I teach that purpose and audience must go together. So you are writing for a purpose to a particular audience, and you have to keep that audience in mind when you write. And so I think if you're writing I think this is an answer maybe, and you can totally shoot it down. But if you're writing to the editor of the New York Times and you want to make a point, you're going to write differently, whoever you are, than if you're writing to, a text to your friend.
Sure. I think so. To answer the concrete question and then talk about purpose and audience, we could look at these practices and say, oh, you pronounce this way. There are other people who would pronounce this way. And we could try to, as teachers, if we're in a position of authority, try to present those as a neutral, valueless judgment and say, oh, the way you did it is good and the way these other people do it is good and everybody's doing good things. You just figure out whether you want to keep doing your good thing or this other good thing that everybody else does that is institutionally welcomed and legitimated. And your thing, probably won't work out for you in that direction. But if you want to keep doing that, that's great. And so it ends up sort of when the rubber meets the road, presenting you with some situations where you have to take up these issues.
Right.
Part of what is most interesting to me is, on one level, the way in which even when particular populations seem to engage in practices that correspond to the rules, that they're still not viewed or experienced as corresponding to the rules. So we can talk about this in relation to race, class, gender, lots of situations where women are experienced as being aggressive, as gruff, or as quiet and as passive. When they're engaging in practices that when men engage in these practices, they're taking for granted as normal, as regular, as unmarked. And so if we look at this in relation to race, gender, class, we find that even when you've mastered the rule, it's still not enough. And at that point, it suggests to me that maybe what we should be paying attention to are our systems and our structures and our institutional ways of viewing people, rather than trying to change the practices of marked people themselves. So rather than trying to sort of ask students to fit into this rubric, saying, where did we get these rubrics from and how is it that they may have skewed our perception? So when I'm working on the ground with students, it involves sort of saying, what are the different sorts of practices that we could be recognizing that you could be engaging in? And as you've suggested, Denise, why might you strategically engage in this practice and why might not you?
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We will have more with Jonathan Rosa talking about language and race and ethnicity and differences and what's a poor teacher to do next on SiriusXM Insight 121.
Students focus on what they were told, not paying attention to the situation.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
So they're not going to see anything new because they're so busy trying to copy what you told them.
From the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Jonathan Rosa today about language and differences in the way people speak and write and understand one another.
Right. So lots of variation in language runs on different lines. And we sort of want to be open to all of it. We want to be fluent. But I get confused a little bit in the theoretical space here. So as I understand it, originally we used the expression code switch.
What does that mean?
Jonathan's going to explain.
Oh, Jonathan's going to tell us.
I would prefer to have an expert as opposed.
That's probably good.
So we code switch, and then I think we moved to Spanglish, and now we're doing something called translanguaging.
Translate. Right now, can Jonathan translate?
Yes. Please give me your theory of all three in four sentences. Now, what is going on in the way we view people moving around different language spaces?
Yeah, these concepts are really interesting. They reflect efforts to sort of grapple with the question of linguistic boundaries and what's the relationship between boundaries between what look like two different languages and the relationship between boundaries that separate varieties of a language. Mm-hmm. So are those both kinds of switching or code switching, or is one a style shift versus a code switch? So when you're switching between varieties of English, say formal or informal, or New England versus West Coast, are those style shifts or code switches? And so these sorts of boundaries are something that linguists and sociolinguists have looked at for some time. So the question of the move from, say, code switching to Spanglish to translanguaging is really interesting. I mean, I think the effort with Spanglish was sort of to say, wait, these practices that in which particular populations engage that were once viewed as a sign of a lack of linguistic ability. So when people seem to be using two languages at the same time, is that a reflection of their inability or their lack of a full proficiency in relation to one of those languages so that then they use the other language as a so-called crutch, this kind of thing? And so the Spanglish literature was largely a response to those kinds of viewpoints to say, no, Spanglish is its own system, and it in fact demonstrates mastery of two codes. And so what you thought was someone's limited ability in relation to two codes is someone's, in fact, profound dexterity. Then you get a translanguaging perspective, which has emerged over the last 20 years or so, that has reflected an approach to language to say, wait, why did we think that languages are separate from one another in the first place? Why have we imagined that there is this thing that is English, it is lives in this box in the world, there is this thing that is French or Spanish or German or X, Y, and Z language, and of course I've used normative sorts of languages as examples here, but why did we imagine that they were separate from each other in the first place? And if we have all this evidence that you give me any linguistic practice and I can show how it's simultaneously linked to so many different languages, then why did we pretend that it's just English? So I joke with people all the time in the United States when I say the idea that, for example, Spanish is a foreign language in the United States is quite funny, since the presence of Spanish predated the presence of English here. And Spanish is in so many, the use of Spanish with its own colonial history in the United States is imbued into so many of our experiences. So we don't typically think of the state like Montana is as Montaña, but Montaña is the Spanish word for mountain. Colorado, colorado, which means reddish, this sort of thing. So these seem like English forms that are in fact Spanish and English at the same time. But why do we only experience them as English right now and not as Spanish? And so a translanguaging perspective is trying to say, wait, what if we approach languages as being intertwined and interconnected in all kinds of interesting ways? And what sort of an approach to learning would emerge out of that?
So what sort of approach to learning should emerge out of it? You set yourself up there. Like,
sure.
What should we be doing?
Sure. I think it raises new questions about what linguistic skills look like. So what if, in fact, if you sit with a group of elementary school students who were raised in lots of different linguistic environments, what if you were able to understand them not simply in relation to their perceived lack of standard English, but rather in relation to the profound kinds of linguistic knowledge that they're bringing to that learning space? And then we could talk about varieties of English that they might learn in school, but what if you presume upon their knowledge in the first place? So different skills, different knowledges, different participants in learning. So suddenly people have linguistic skills everywhere rather than simply within the classroom. And I worry that the kind of language use that we've privileged and the ways that we've constructed our schools is based on an assumption about what counts as legitimate language. And that's just a small sliver of what language is. And yet we've elevated it to this status and used it and weaponized it really against particular kinds of populations.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're speaking with Jonathan Rosa about weaponizing language. That's a really powerful phrase.
So now I have to stand by that.
Well, you don't have to stand by it, but I think, so should we not be teaching English and formal grammar? Should we not be,
Can I separate out? So one part of this is where we started, which is everybody speaks quite well. Language is something that everybody's good at. Reading is different. Reading is something that sort of evolution didn't imbue us with that. But language, we communicate extremely well. To have people come in and say, oh, their language is not up to snuff, it is a slap in the face. It's right. So that's part one. That still doesn't tell me the other part, which is, should I build on those resources? Should I just say, good, you're good at language, I'm going to teach you another one? Should I give you minus points every time you use your home language? So I just kind of want to separate out the claim that everybody's good at language, which is important for people to understand. It's the written word that's where you get lots of differences in abilities because it's something that you gain through culture.
Yeah, everyone is good at language. That statement in itself is quite a radical statement based on the ways that we tend to approach language within schools.
I see.
Which is to assume that certain families and certain people are good with language. Certain families are doing the right thing with language at home and other families aren't. In fact, what we find, and I always have to say to administrators and teachers who, for very good reasons, based on their efforts to adhere to policy, they feel as though they have to get their students to perform linguistically in very particular ways. And they say, we have this problem with our English learners or this problem with standard English and this sort of thing. And I have to say to them, first, it's my job as a linguistic anthropologist to tell you humans are really good at language and don't have a problem with language, at least in general. And so then I would want to think about the ways that institutionally language has come to be experienced as a problem, how and why. And what I find so often is that what we've constructed as academic language or school language, you can find examples of that language use outside of school all the time. So why have we relegated that language use specifically to school and then framed everything that happens outside of school as somehow unacademic or non-academic?
Because when you corrected the advertisements at the grocery store, they were annoyed. You were bringing school outside.
Absolutely. And
this is the grocery store. We don't have to have proper grammar.
Well, there was some question about the relevance of particular sorts of insights and practices and norms. But I think the literacy question is quite interesting for me, too. I do think that it's important to recognize the particularity of what literacy is as opposed to spoken language or other sorts of the different ways that language is practiced. But similar to spoken language, I find that people are engaging in profound literacy practices. And so here at Stanford, a former colleague of ours, an emeritus colleague of ours, Shirley Bryce Heath, famously wrote the book more than 30 years ago now, or about 30 years ago, Ways with Words. And she has this article that is brilliant that people always misread. And the title of the article is What No Bedtime Story Means. And the assumption historically has been, if you don't have a bedtime story, you're not going to be successful in school. And then you have people like myself, who, I'm a PhD linguistic anthropologist and I didn't have a bedtime story. And people presume that, you must have suffered then. And the idea is, no, I experienced literacy in different ways that didn't correspond to those norms, but that didn't mean that I was any less capable of succeeding or learning within school. It just meant I was bringing different norms to the classroom.
I mean, that's really powerful, right? That you can grow up without a bedtime story and be just as linguistically proficient as those who do. It doesn't mean don't read to your kids.
No, I think a bedtime story could be great, although the way some people practice bedtime stories is not so great,
yeah.
When it can become an adversarial situation between a parent and a child and this sort of thing. So a bedtime story can be wonderful, but it's one among infinite literacy practices in which one could engage that could be, supportive or meaningful or beneficial for learning more broadly.
So I'm not allowed to say someone's better than someone else.
Well, as soon as we start to rank things in that way, I can find infinite contradictions to demonstrate why the person who allegedly is more proficient, I can show you all of their lack of proficiency.
Better 80% of the time?
See, those quantifications get really complicated for me. I immediately, as soon as we sort of assume that those rankings, I immediately try to find the contradictions.
Jonathan, thank you so much for being here. And thank all of you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app on iTunes and SoundCloud.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.